Okay, so welcome everybody. As we usually do, we'll start with announcements. Are there any announcements that people would like to make? I do know that the GSA has gone through their process of accepting sessions, and I believe our two climate literacy sessions were accepted. One is basically focused around formal and informal educational contexts, and then the other session is focused around research, educational research, and evaluation efforts in terms of making progress in improving climate literacy. So we'll be advertising those sessions. I actually don't think the abstracts are due until something like July or something like that. But this everybody knows. Are there any other announcements?
Now, Tamara, did you, this is Linda, did you work on, I've missed a couple teleconferences, on the sessions that are upcoming for AGU like you did last year?
We have, let's see, I think we need to put together session proposals, but we haven't done that yet. I actually don't know when the deadline is. We should figure that out.
It's April 20th.
April 20th. Okay, so, yeah, I was kind of thinking it might be April. So we should start to think about that, too. We can talk about that during a Climate Literacy Network call that we don't have a presentation on.
Right, yeah.
Okay, any other announcements?
Just all the sad news from the federal budget.
Yeah, it was real depressing seeing those emails.
But like they say, it's not over till the fat lady sings, so we're going to wait.
Yeah.
And be hopeful.
Yes. Okay, well, if there are no other announcements, we'll move on to our presentation for today. We have Jennifer Provencher from the Association of Polar Early Career Scientists. Jennifer is a graduate student at Carleton University in Canada and was involved in both research, I believe, and educational aspects of the IPY, the International Polar Year, and was, I think, part of one of the founders of APEX. And so she's going to talk to us today about how APEX continues to shape the future of polar research. And everybody should be able to access her slides from the website, either PDF format or PowerPoint format. So, Jennifer, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. So I wanted to say thank you for having me present to you today. I also want to apologize. I've been a little under the weather for the last couple of days, so I apologize that my title of my talk does not match what I actually sent Scott. But I'm very excited to be here today and to share both what APEX is continuing to do and some of the results that we've actually gotten from doing an assessment of the education and outreach and communication during the last IPY. And so I'll go through those two things. So I'll move on to my second slide. I'm not sure if most people are in PDF or PowerPoint, but I'll just, there's a few animations that I think will be lost, but that's okay. So I'm on the slide that says, what is APEX? And just for those of you who are not familiar, we are an association of early career researchers. We try to be as inclusive as possible. And we have a membership of about 3,000 people spread in about 76 countries. And our interests lie basically in everything that's polar. And that includes polar marine biology, to polar social studies, to polar law, to polar literature. And we formed during the International Polar Year as one of the objectives of IPY was to engage early career scientists. And so that basically came out as APEX. And Jenny Baseman, who is actually the founder, and Hugues Lantouy, who is from Germany, they were the founders, but they have had a lot of help and support along the way and that their baby, as Apex is usually referred to, has grown beyond even their expectations in the last 5 years. So we're actually coming up on just our fifth anniversary. So I'll move on to the next slide. So one of the areas that we do is we do a ton of research activities. One of our primary goals is to connect and teach early career researchers and give them opportunities within the researcher field. And you can see we have a number of programs, virtual poster sessions, which bring together young researchers to share their findings and their research. Disciplines of the Month also happen all the way through the year. We are actually just coming up on a Social Science Month, and I believe we're currently in a Terrestrial Ecology Month. And so we try to cycle through different topics so that we can engage different groups of our membership. We have field sites. We have a whole list of different things, and a lot of it is based on collecting information and putting it into a single place for people to go to, rather than having resources scattered across the internet that people don't really know about. And the next slide is APEX and career development. This is one of our strongest, and I would argue more important, areas that we do work in. There are often what we call soft skills that graduates are expected to know as they leave graduate school and go on to become researchers or educators in the world of academia, or if they're going on in policy or a whole number of areas that they're expected to know, including how to give a presentation and communicate with policymakers and do education outreach. And we find that they don't know how to do any of these things. There are many people are not given formal or informal guidance in this. And so we, through a wide variety of workshops and schools and webinars that we do each week, we try to give our membership these different skills so they can go on and be really successful and contribute to the polar research community in general. And I'll go on to the next slide. So education and outreach is one of our biggest areas. Education and outreach, although is only a third or one of our committees, it's the one I'm particularly the most interested in. Just for a little bit of background about myself, I'm doing my PhD and I work in marine birds, and so I'm very much a scientist. But before I went back to school, I actually was a high school teacher and trained and worked in high schools both in the north and in the south. And so I've been very involved in the education and outreach, both within APEX and then outside of APEX as well. And this is an area that we find that our members in general are lacking resources and time and not always recognition for doing these types of activities. And so we have a huge number of members who are in the science stream and are doing PhDs in science, but are interested in doing more education and outreach, or potentially not necessarily going into the traditional academic world or research world and taking their science and applying it to a more education outreach communication field. And so one of the things that APEX has done in collaboration with several other groups is the Polar Resource Book, and you may be familiar with this. It was a product during IPUI and has several chapters, including chapters on activities that people can do in the classroom as teachers, but also for early career researchers who are wanting to go into the classroom and create their own activity. We do connections from the field. We are part of Antarctica Day. And there's a few other things that are going on, including Frostbite, which is part of the upcoming IPUI Montreal conference, where researchers or early career researchers do a 30 to 60 second soundbite of their research to be able to share on an audio level and actually archive some of the things that are happening. The one that's not up here that I'll touch upon a little bit later is Polar Week. And so during IPUI, I'm sure many people here knew or maybe involved with the polar week that happened. They started with polar days, and then by the end they had moved into polar week. And so the Education and Outreach Committee of APEX is also, we're working on another polar week. So we're taking some of those lessons learned, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. And we're trying to connect people who were connected through IPY, but students have kind of lost that connection into what's happening without that international polar year program office leading us on. Can everyone hear me? Am I going slow enough for everyone?
Yep, no, you're doing fine.
Okay, great. So I'm going into the next slide now. So this is, I'm going to switch now to talking very specifically about the assessment that APEX led and managed that looked at the outreach program during the International Polar Year. And so for IPY, the planning group set out to have an impact on a global scale. They wanted to target key audience, and they wanted to have important messages and themes set aside. And the International Polar Year was a huge effort. So if we go on to the next slide, we have IPY, the infamous honeycomb chart that I'm sure many of you have seen. And we can see that the education and outreach section, it was an entire part of IPY. It was a very important part. And some have argued that the education outreach component of IPY is potentially one of the most highly invested in outreach, science outreach initiatives ever. And so if we go to the next slide, but we still have this question of what can we learn from the outreach efforts during IPY. We had this huge global effort, and we had millions of people connected. And so IPY really is this microcosm of science, outreach, information, but no one, no one has done a real international assessment, and even on a national level, with the big countries that had really coordinated IPY efforts, such as the U.S. and Canada and Norway, there has been really no assessment, and really, in some ways, very little inventory even. So Jenny Baseman, who's one of the founders of APEX, and Dave Carlson, formerly of the IPY International Program Office, applied to ICSU, which is the International Council for Science. They're one of the main sponsoring bodies of the International Polar Year, along with WMO, the World Meteorological Office. They put together a team of educators and communicators and researchers to form the IPY EOC Assessment Committee. And this is a team that is really focused on trying to understand what happened and what can we learn from it. And so our next slide, why was IPY EOC a success? So Dave and Jenny put this team together, and I was hired to manage this team and to lead this team of about 14 people. And really, everyone, at least in our circles, in most circles, we always claim that IPY EOC was very successful, but we had to take a step back, and we wanted to actually ask the question in a more quantitative way, was IPY EOC actually successful? And so we went back to the objectives of the IPY planning group. And we see them there. They're 1, 2, 3, global scale, target audience, and those important messages. And we had to assess whether, before we could assess, you know, what we learned from it, we needed to assess whether we'd actually met those goals or not. So our next slide, number one, so our global scale, this is the first question. And so what we did is we went back and we did a huge survey and a huge inventory and document analysis of all of the IPY programs that were submitted in either national reports or online or through the Polar Resource Book. And we tried to track down as much information as we could from as many different places as we could. And we found that IPY EOC projects were reported from more than 70 countries. And that was a huge success. IPY officially, from a science perspective, happened in 66 countries where they either had offices or science programs involved. And so one of the really exciting things was that the education projects actually reached further than our science projects. And as educators, when I tell this to educators kind of go, of course it did, you know, it's not a big surprise. But to scientists, this is a bit surprising, especially to the science, the Joint Committee. They had a very successful and very widespread science program, but I think it really speaks to the educators and communicators involved to see that we had those programs reached even further. And then the next slide, number two, wide audiences. So this is one way that we looked at our audiences, is we looked through, again, this is a survey, some of our survey results. We had more than 250 programs surveyed, and these were the audiences that they were targeting. So you can see secondary school, again, probably not a surprise to most of us that that was our most targeted group. And it goes all the way through, and we included groups like media and government organizations as well, just to understand where people were focusing their outreach efforts. And when we add up all of these groups, and we actually did another question where we had them estimate their audiences, if we take the lower bracket, we can estimate that IPY EOC reached more than 14 million people. And that's a very low, low conservative estimate. It's probably much more likely that it reached about 20 to 22 million people.
Jennifer, this is Scott Carley
yeah.
here. I'm just curious what the axis is on this slide. Is that percentage of that 14 million, you know, is for
yes.
secondary school, or is it, I can't quite figure out what that would be, numbers or percentage?
Yeah, no, I'm sorry, that's a percentage.
Is it percentage? Okay.
Yes. Sorry.
Great. Thank you.
So that doesn't account for potential overlaps?
Yes.
No, we have no potential. We have no way to, in our particular survey, we have no way to account for overlaps.
Okay.
Yep. That's pretty wide.
And in our third goal that we assessed was those important messages and themes. And so one of the ways that we did this, and one of the ways I find to do this the most visually for presentations specifically, is to what we take is we took all of the titles of all of the programs. So we actually in our inventory have about 550 programs, and we take the titles of all of those programs and we put them into a very fun online tool called Wordle. And what we get is this. And so this is, as words are used more often, they become bigger. And the smaller words are the words that are less are used less frequently. And so obviously we can see polar and Arctic and Antarctica and IPY come out. But there's some, you know, it's interesting to see outreach and student come out as well as sea and global. And we can actually see a few countries start to come out. Canada is a big one there. Norway is also a big one there. And so we're seeing some of our themes, specifically like snow and ice and sea, they all start to come out here in this Wordle when we look at all of the different programs. So the next slide, so we know that IPY was successful by its own goals. And those goals, this is a very... you know, post-hoc analysis of IPY success, because those goals were quite broad and because we were doing this after the fact. And so a lot of us, again, would argue that IPY was successful. And we can see now by its own goals that it was, but why? And many would argue that, you know, looking at, you don't have to look far for the science of success. But what we really want to know about IPY EOC is why was it so successful, and what made it so great, and all of the things that it did. So if we move on to the next slide, I'm just going to go through a few of the reasons that we found why IPY EOC was successful. So number one, and this is one that people have argued with in a lot of ways, and was that EOC was integrated into a larger science program from the very, very beginning. And so back in 2006, when the IPY newsletter came out, you know, issue one there was already updates on IPY education outreach activities. And so this is something that EOC was something that IPY designated as important from the very, very beginning and integrated into its larger program. The next one, number two, was that the EOC efforts engaged and involved experts in both science and communication. And this is feedback that we've gotten again and again and again from many different areas, both from scientists as well as communicators. And so we have 71% of our projects surveyed actually had projects with communication, personnel with communication experiences involved in the project. And only, you know, in the balance had no communication personnel. There's a huge number of people involved in EOC during IPY, researchers, graduate students, communication experts, a whole huge number. And it was the integration of all of these different skill sets that made a lot of the IPY projects really highly, highly successful. Number three, our next slide, is that EOC was coordinated and encouraged from the central office. And this is a big one. Again, we got a lot of feedback on this through our surveys. Miriam Helbig Almeida in Brazil, she was one of the she was a very active participant in IPY outreach. And we had her as well as a number of other people who very, very specifically pointed to the IPY IPO. And how they coordinate activities and supply people with connections. And so this is a really big thing that we found was the central coordination, the central link that people could tap into. And our next slide was that, and the next reason is that the EOC program is branded and inclusive. And again, we see this coming up over and over again, is that the International Polar Year was branded. It was very, very much had this logo and color scheme and all of these things. But it was a free logo that people could use. And it was a logo that was not highly guarded. It was not highly controlled. It was very much able for teacher groups, opportunities, activities, blogs, images, you know, all these places could use this logo. And they had this website that was easy, well, relatively easy to navigate. And so they pulled in a whole different group of people. And this actually was very, very meaningful because we looked at when all of our IPY activities started. And there was a huge number, about 35% of our IPY, what we called IPY outreach activities, actually started in the middle of IPY. And they weren't necessarily associated with IPY, but they were activities that people wanted to do and took up during IPY because they were excited and wanted to be part of this bigger thing. And if IPY logo and if they're, you know, what we called IPY EOC wasn't as inclusive, those activities may never have gotten off the ground if they couldn't have tied into this bigger thing and then been included in discussion groups. And Google Groups to learn more about what was going on. And then the number five, the next slide, why we were successful. One of them is this big thing is that we had advocacy. And advocacy for outreach during the IPY period happened at the beginning. There was a strong group of people who pushed to have outreach as a part of IPY. I would love to be able to stand here and tell you everyone thought outreach was a good idea, but unfortunately I can't. But because of a few people who continually push for it, it maintains throughout the IPY, even in Oslo and all the way up into our next conference in Montreal, there's a core group that are pushing to have education and outreach at the forefront. And this has been a really key part. And there's a few faces. Some of them are probably very recognizable to some of you. And these are just a few of the faces who continue to work really, really hard to make sure that education and outreach wasn't left as a side project of IPY, but instead played an active, prominent role during IPY. The last one I'm going to talk about why we were successful is number six, and this is our polar issues for timely and topical. And so as much as IPUI was successful because of coordination and people, we also have to recognize that there were a few incidents. One, the collapse of the Larsen B shelf in 2003, and then also a rapid decline in the Arctic summer sea ice during the IPUI that really spurred on global interest. And so there, specifically in the media, there was a huge interest that generated pre and during IPUI for polar issues because of these things and because they could pick them up. And there are lots of people who kind of were picking up these stories and then learning about IPUI and then moving forward on those things. And so IPUI outreach was really successful because it was timely and you know, for better or for worse, it was topical during the time period. So we have put all of our outreach activities that we collected for this assessment into a catalog. I can give you the address. It's apex.is is our main page, and you can find it on the menu on the left-hand side there when you go there. It is a bit of a large catalog. It's over 530, I believe, now. And you can search it by keywords, and so you can go in and put the U.S. in, and you can find all of the activities that happen in the U.S., or you can put, you know, Andrel in, and you can find all the activities that Andrel was associated with. And so it is searchable and online and open. And so this is one of the things that we're really happy to be able to do. It is the only international inventory of the outreach activities during IPUI. So this is my last little section, and now I'm going to just focus on the lessons that we've learned. So, you know, we've examined that IPUI was successful. We've looked about why it was successful and what contributed to that success. And really, this is the part that ICSU was interested in, and what are the lessons that we've learned. So ICSU is, as I said, the International Council of Science. And they, their members they have a huge membership, and a lot of those members are like the geochemistry unions and AGU and SCAR and IAS core polar groups are members. And so they want to know what went right through IPUI and how do we take those lessons and move them forward into other initiatives. And one of the things that we learned, though I'm sure this is no surprise to anyone on this call, is that public and students and teachers and artists and everyone who, you know, the public wants to be actively engaged in science. This is something that I think that most people who work in education and communication totally understand. But again, there's a lot of groups who don't necessarily believe this, and there's even the literature I find it interesting when this is debatable. And basically what we found through IPUI is that absolutely everyone wants to be actively engaged in science, all the way from the primary school level all the way up into the post-secondary. They want to be actively engaged. The next thing we have, I have animation issues a little bit, but the next thing that we have is that professionals in science and communication, one of the really frustrating things is that they lacked professional recognition for their outreach activities. And so what we're seeing is that although professionals and early career researchers were excited about doing EOC, there's very little professional, basically, ways to express what they've done, and they're not getting that professional recognition. They're not getting recognition from the supervisors. And in some cases, unfortunately, we still have students who are being told to limit their outreach activities by their supervisors. They're being told that, you know, science is their job and not outreach. And one of the arguments I would make is that the early career researchers, as you can see in the picture on the left, they're really going to be the lead researchers for our next international polar year. And if we don't figure out a way to support and recognize the outreach efforts of early career researchers and all researchers between now and then we're going to take a huge step backwards in education outreach. We need to support the people who want to do outreach, and so that we can move forward and have even more of it. The third one is mostly about connections. So our next slide. So number three is that our small-scale projects benefit greatly by being linked to larger outreach initiatives. And the best example I have for this is Polar Days turning into Polar Weeks. And so IPY planned these Polar Days where this one day would happen and all these people would sign in and they would have webinars and they would launch virtual balloons. And by the end, it just wasn't enough, but they had to have whole Polar Weeks. It grew to involve 49 countries on all of the continents, and many smaller projects from classrooms to community groups all were joining into these larger events. And so it's these larger events that, again, are inclusive and can allow people to make connections on a larger scale that they normally can't. These are what really, really work and draw in a lot of those audiences. Next slide, we're going to go on to number four here. And I was really excited to hear you talking about some formal outreach assessment topics in our opening catch-up there. But this is what we're finding, is that formal outreach assessment is still really lacking, and it needs to be really prioritized. You know, in science, we still expect review and assessment of science, and yet science education, we're putting money into science education, and yet we're not doing any assessment. And so if we're really going to move forward with science education, we need to ensure that the goals are being met and how we're doing that. And so we found that very few evaluations were done. Only 28% of our outreach activities had any type of assessment done at all. And we found that there was actually a few that their programs were funded, but the assessments were not. And so we're still missing a link. There have been a few really great assessments done for IPY, and I can share those with you if you're interested. But for the most part, this is a huge lacking in most of what we're seeing in IPY. Number five, so our next slide is we have our science EOC in many ways has moved beyond our traditional poster or pamphlet, which some scientists love to create and most communicators love to hate, but more needs to be done. And so we've done really well during IPY to reach out and touch a whole bunch of different audiences, mostly through the use of online tools, but there are still a huge number of people out there that think going to conferences or doing posters or pamphlets is a good way or an effective way to carry out their outreach. That's not saying that those aren't important parts for some groups, but there are still a group of scientists out there who need to think beyond the realm of the traditional outreach. And we can see here, this is actually a Wordle with all of the communication tools, again, put in. And we see, you know, obviously classroom is big, one of the really great things that we came out was that scientists love going into classrooms. And I don't think most of you need to hear that, but it was really great to get that much feedback that scientists really enjoy going to classrooms and often wish they could do it more. But we do see conference still coming up there quite big. And we did see a few people still think that's kind of good enough to go and present at a science conference or to present at a traditional poster at a science conference as a form of education and outreach. We're coming to the end here, but the next slide is number six. And one of the things that we have learned, and this is where the APEX Polar Week is kind of coming in a little bit, is that we need institutions and organizations with more of a long-term memory, long-term initiative to take on some of the networks. During the International Polar Year, they brought together an amazing amount of teachers and educators and communicators from all over the world. But post-IPY, we have basically seen those communication networks just kind of wither. And so what we're trying to do through this Polar Week that we're doing is reestablish some of those connections. And although we, you know, IPY is over and we're not going to have as huge of a network potentially as before, we want to have a network that people can go to and get involved with, again, some of these larger activities that they can tap into without having to kind of be by themselves. And lastly, I think this is the last one, number 7, one of the big things that we really took away is that science outreach efforts in general need to work with organizations that already have EOC capacity and audiences. The International Polar Year, although there are mumblings of an International Polar Decade, the International Polar Year is done. And there is no more funding, but science education outreach and polar education outreach is still a hugely important part of what we do. And so the best way to move forward with this is actually to partner with organizations such as universities and museums and art galleries that have this built-in capacity and already have a built-in audience. And so one of the things that we're really trying to do is support and encourage our researchers and our early career researchers to go out and form relationships with some of these groups so that they can contribute to infrastructure that's already there rather than trying to create the wheel again. So just in summary, one of the things that we have taken away from doing this study is that IPY was successful, and it was because many, many people worked really hard to make it all happen. In general, the public was very excited, and they want more active science in the classrooms. And scientists are happy to do it, and scientists really, really want to go out and do more education outreach. But unfortunately, support and resources are needed. And educators and communicators also are a very key ingredient in having this successful IPY EOC program. So just to come back to APEX, just the next year in APEX, we have a few things happening. We actually, Jenny Baseman, who is our director currently, she has taken on a new job, and so we're actually looking for a new director currently. So if you know anyone who's interested, please feel free to pass it on. We are having a Polar Week coming up in March. There's just a bit of a typo. But Polar Week is coming up in March with, I believe it's from March 18th to 24th. And we are working with ARCUS to have a webinar that will connect researchers both in Antarctica and in the Arctic to anyone who wants to sign in and join. And a few other things, including creating some content for people to, both teachers as well as early career researchers, to be able to go into the classroom with. And I'm happy to give more information to those who are interested. And we do have a meeting in Montreal coming up, which is a huge event. I think they're expecting about 2,200 people. I know they got about 2,000 abstracts, so it should be a very good meeting. And there is an education outreach meeting or a section area in that within the meeting, which is very encouraging. So, and we're working really hard to make it as engaging and as integrated as we can within the science realm. So we have educators talking about science projects that they were involved in, and then we have scientists talking about education projects they were involved in as well. The APEX, for those of you, if you have visited the APEX website, it can be a bit of a beast even at the best of times. And so we're getting a bit of a facelift to help us streamline our resources better and connect those who want to be in the different groups. And this is my last slide, and I just wanted to say many thanks to all of those people. This is a huge project that I am just one of many people in. Jenny Baseman and Dave Carlson are the major drivers behind the IPY assessment project, and Alan Pope, who was the president of APEX last year, was a big help throughout the program, as well as coming into this year as well. And so they've all been very supportive, and I'm happy to take any questions if you have any.
So Jennifer, thank you very much. I have one question, especially with respect to this last set of activities that you're talking about.
since IPY ended, how are these this Montreal meeting and your website and activities being funded?
So APEX is a standalone organization. We get funding. We actually are a very small organization with a very big membership. So we have one position that's paid. We have a director who is based in Tromsø, Norway, and we are actually currently funded by the Norwegian Polar, the Norwegian Research Council, and by the University of Tromsø in northern Norway. And so we have independent funding, and then we also have we have projects, and so we get money from ICSU, we got money from ICSU to run this specific project. We get little pockets of money from SCAR and IAS.
Are you housed somewhere through which the money goes, or is APEX a fundable organization in itself?
APEX is a nonprofit organization based in Norway.
Okay, and the IPY Montreal meeting, how is that funded?
So the IPY Montreal meeting is being primarily hosted by the Canadian government. And so we have a huge number of sponsors, but the secretariat and the organizing committee, a lot of that is coming out of the Canadian government.
Okay, well, I have other questions, but I'll give others a chance. Are there other people who have questions out there? Well, Jennifer, I actually see a lot of parallels between what APEX accomplished in terms of outreach and the connection between the scientific and broader communities and a lot of what the Climate Literacy Network and issues around climate change want to achieve. So I think there might be a lot of lessons learned there for us.
Yeah, and one thing I wanted to say is that we did this survey, and one thing to note is that it was a huge survey, and it was support. We did it through SurveyMonkey, and this is we're scratching the surface here in terms of the data. And if anyone who is really keen on examining, some of our data for, who has more patterns and who has a better history and a better eye for some of these patterns of education assessment, I'd be happy to chat with them, because we don't really have the capacity at APEX to take this survey much farther, but the amount of data that's within our surveys is quite large.
Well, actually, that's interesting. I might be interested in talking to you further about that.
Yeah, I'd love to talk to you about it.
Okay. Are there other questions?
This is Frank Newfold over at NOAA. I have a question.
Okay, go ahead.
So, we were involved in IPY back at the beginning of this, and it was an interesting kind of experience for us to think about working in engagement in climate without actually necessarily focusing exclusively on climate. And while a lot of us in the IPY community were principally focused on climate as well, but we did it under the polar focus, because it was easier to make traction on that. It offers an interesting kind of case study to say, engagement in climate when people are having a hard time with the word climate or climate change or whatever you want to call it, can understand changes in our Earth system and how science works without actually necessarily starting with climate. Did any of that show up in any of the research? I mean, this is more of a U.S. issue, but not exclusively. Other countries are struggling in this area as well, more so now than in the past. But did any of this show up in any of the survey work?
I largely no, or at least it hasn't shown up in the way that we've looked at it. One of the questions that we did put out there was, what theme did your IPY outreach address? And we put the themes out there, and the themes were ice, sea, land, people, and climate. And then I also threw in climate change just to see what people would do. And it was amazing, the number of people who ticked off climate change. And so we didn't do it directly, but I think people, and specifically, well, some people, is that they, you know, climate change, they use IPY to push climate change discussions potentially further ahead, and that's the feeling I get. But we didn't have, at least from the, how I've looked at the data, we haven't had that come through. But the fact that climate change was not a theme, and yet it was a common theme that ran through many, many, many people's things, is also quite interesting in and upon itself.
Right. So, I mean, maybe drilling in on where somebody didn't choose climate change might be interesting to explore what the motivation was for not talking about climate change.
Yeah. And we can actually, we do have the breakdown of the surveys, who, you know, who wrote, you know, how many of our groups were from, are from America, and how many are from the Canada, and how many are from, you know, Norway and stuff. So it, we could do that. We can go back and look at what our breakdown is, and who was talking about climate, and who was, you know, in what areas, and who was, you know, listed to climate change.
But you did say that climate change did emerge as a theme, even though it wasn't explicitly asked about.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. No, I remember a lot of the discussions back in those days, and I mean, if you talk to anybody who was working in this, while it wasn't explicitly climate change engagement, I mean, implicitly it was. So in practice it was, but we didn't talk about it in such because, you know, this was 2006, 2007, and it wasn't as easy to move forward, especially in the U.S.
Yeah.
So I have another question with respect to your organization, APEX. It explicitly says early career scientists, but you also listed as professors as being members. Is there, I mean, is there a point at which you outgrow the system, or you just become a mentor to an early career scientist? How does that work?
Yeah, and so this is something that we're constantly thinking about, because again, one of the lessons from IPY is to be as inclusive as we can, and so we're actually getting to the point where some of our earliest founding members, who were, you know, in their late stages of their PhDs, are now, you know, definitely not early career researchers anymore. And so what we're currently doing is transitioning. So some of our members are becoming mentors. The other thing is we have, you know, we're called the research of, or the Association of Polar Early Career Scientists. But we have educators and communicators as part of our membership too, because they find it a really valuable resource, especially as IPY slowed down and APEX kind of in some ways took up those education and communicator networks. And so we do have a transition when our members outgrow the membership area and they become a mentor. But we also have educators, communicators, and teachers who are considered mentors/members. So it's a very gray area, but we have maybe a better way to say it is we have a network of over 3,000 people who are at various stages in their careers.
Okay, great. Jenny, this is Linda Morris.
Hi.
And I just wanted to touch back on your comment that, you know, assessment is frequently not performed and or the funding for outreach is frequently removed. And I wondered if APEX or, you know, what others have as ideas about addressing policy in your outreach, policy makers, because it seems that, you know, whether it's NSF or maybe entities within Canada or elsewhere that are making those decisions to kind of separate out the outreach from the science, that maybe some top-down change of paradigm at the funders might help us to integrate those back in so that impact can be shown and funding is available to, you know, better perform the outreach.
Yeah, and that's a really great question, and I think that's one of the things that we have, so ICSU, the International Council of Science, was our sponsor, and that was one of the things that they're really interested in. So both the education assessment and then also this idea of professional recognition for science outreach, specifically mm-hmm. the science perspective. Those are the two things that ICSU is really interested in and hearing and knowing about. And so from a policy perspective, and I'd love to hear more opinions on this, but those are two areas that we've worked with ICSU on really formulating our ideas and formulating facts and figures that they can then take to their membership. And it, at least in the UK, what I actually, I've heard some very encouraging results. So NERC, which is the equivalent of NSF in the UK, they actually had a scientist recently not do their outreach component. And they checked and actually threatened to take all of their funding, including their science funding, away if they didn't do their outreach component. So I'm very encouraged by some stories, but I don't think that those stories are widespread enough yet.
Yeah, I think the general is that they don't. They're asked to do it, but nobody ever checks if they did it or how well it was done and what was achieved.
Yeah, exactly. So. And I think I'm still very encouraged. I mean, I think that the fact that people are starting to check is a big step forward, and I think one of at least my through talking to people is what we need, and I've felt this myself in my own science, is that I think we need more connections between scientists and then professional people who understand the world of assessment.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like we've made a lot of bridges in terms of having scientists, you know, work with teachers more and a little bit work with communicators, but people who are more interested specifically in assessment to start having those same connections. And that would move it forward. And I think, and if the other thing that as a scientist is really important is unfortunately, I don't think this is going away anytime soon, is publish or perish. And so as a scientist, one of the things that I've been really successful with convincing my superiors to put money and time into, or allowing me to put time into, is if I can show that this assessment or this outreach is going to end up in something that is publishable, they can take that, you know, up to their boss and say, this is a product. And so I think we need to encourage, it's encouraging, but we need to make more connections, and we need to have more things that we can take to a publishing level.
Yeah, that's a good idea, good insight.
And again, we have lots of, we actually just launched another survey for our APEX membership, and so we have, you know, one thing that we have access to is these huge networks of people who we can, we've worked with social scientists to help design some of our assessments around, but, you know, a stumbling block for us is where to take those results, and how do we take those results simply from a reporting to a real, you know, assessment of what's going on.
You know, one thing we found at NOAA, Spring Bolt again, was in career scientists, the really important thing to do is to work on the supervisors who manage the performance plans, at least that's how it is for us, and making sure that there is official time in their official duties, if you will, to do education outreach and engagement. Because if you don't do it there, then they're doing it outside their job, or they're getting, dinged for doing too much. So if you don't take care of their professional responsibilities, things, it really is a back pressure on effectively doing it. Not everybody wants to do it, but there are enough people that do that you can really emphasize that in that way. And it helps them, they have cover for doing it because it's part of their job.
Yeah, and I think that's a really important recognition, is that not everyone wants to do it, and I don't think we should make every scientist do outreach necessarily, because I think when some scientists talk to other people, it makes them not want to do science even more. you know, the scientists are a good
paradigm.
We should make sure they do it more.
Right, but, you know, we all have the same experience and the same perspective here. But those who are very good and talented in that they shouldn't be seen as not very good scientists, or you know, they're weak, they're, you know, sacrificing their career for doing this. Or I mean, there's got to be, you got to take care of these people so that they get the rewards and acknowledgement and in real ways. And you know, sometimes it's slick how, you know, the performance plan, they take a hit when they're doing this, got an award for doing wonderful education and outreach or communicator of the year, and then it just got hit with a, you know, not a very good performance review. It's like both these things have to be taken care of simultaneously.
Yeah, and I agree 100%, and that's one of the ways. So there's a few ideas being tossed around. ICSU currently is trying to figure out a way to do that. So, you know, from a scientist perspective, you know, when we publish our papers, we have every journal has an impact factor, and so you can add up all your journals and all your impact factors, and that's a huge part. And so there is some discussion on figuring out a way that at the academic level or the research level that you have it's like a education and outreach impact factor. Like it becomes part of that that assessment and that you know, check in. And hopefully that will see some movement forward in that, because I know that there are a lot of people interested in making that happen. And one of the really interesting results that we're getting back from our early career researchers is that, you know, on a large scale, even when we're talking thousands and thousands of members, that recognition, that lack of recognition, is holding our members back from doing more education outreach.
What kind of recognition do you think is desired?
I think there's a couple of different types. I think that one of them is recognition that it's important. I have a wonderful boss who is very understanding and allows me to do a lot of outreach activities. Some simply don't even have that. But they're also, and one of the things that we are discussing at APEX is a lot of scientists don't understand how to put education and outreach activities on their resume. And so it sometimes is a lack of giving recognition, but also it's sometimes a lack of organizing your own experiences and asking for that recognition.
Isn't it also an issue that, at least in sometimes in tenure processes, it's not only not considered a plus, but sometimes a minus?
Yes, exactly. And so there's some balances going on that we've got to figure out adjustment. And I don't know the best solution, but in the EU, they actually have a very standardized, it's from the EU Commission, where they actually have a whole section on education outreach. And so we're going to do a webinar with some of our members that will show them this kind of format. And, you know, if we prioritize it and we show that that's important to us, maybe that will send up, you know, a message up. But also, I think the other thing is that, again, you know, the young researchers of today are the senior scientists of the next international poll year. And so we've got to figure this out in the next few years, because if we crush the outreach spirit of the early career researchers now, then they're not going to necessarily want to do a lot of outreach for the next 20 years of their career.
Okay, are there any more questions or comments?
I think you've done a good job describing the institutional support systems that need to go into the kind of outreach and education efforts that you've been describing, and including the publications, the higher ed institutions themselves, as well as the grant guidelines and so forth. Do you have any sense from your membership percentage of higher ed institutions and journal/publications that have specifically I don't want to use the words mandated, but acknowledge the importance of education and outreach and set some kind of standard for that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. We haven't asked that question.
I mean, I know it took us, for instance, in Ecological Society of America, years to get a section of the journal dedicated to education submissions so that there was always a place. And I'm wondering if it, at this point all journals accept education submissions.
Yeah, it's a really good question, and I don't have an answer to, but I'd be really interested in asking our membership how they feel about that. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
But my experience is that there, no, not all of them. A lot of the general ones are more accepting, but there are still lots of just pure science journals.
Because it seems to me both that issue of journals accepting education outreach papers, as you've said, and higher ed institutions acknowledging the importance of education and outreach in their tenure policies, are two drivers that, you know, would help move this all forward.
That's interesting, too, because it seems like at least in the U.S. we're making more progress with the science lower-level teachers acknowledging the, you know, contributions of research scientists in their achievements, whereas from the research scientists there hasn't been as much movement acknowledging education as a partner. And it'd be great to get journal articles from with the scientist audience.
Yeah, and I agree, and that's one of the things that I think is one of the things that we're going to try is just with my project, because we do a lot of education in northern communities, and so we're currently working on that in an article, and the article is about, you know, how we can use wildlife studies to provide relevant and place-based educational experiences. So I'll let you know how it goes.
Another place where I've been pushing on is that we've had at the AGU meetings and GSA meetings, we've had education sessions. And for the most part, educators come to the education sessions and scientists go to the scientist sessions. So working to get education talks embedded into science sessions where you actually reach the scientists is a challenge, but very rewarding. I did one where the actual science session was about cryospheric data sets. It was part of some IPY things that I did. And I had a poster where mine was the only education-related poster about using cryospheric data sets, but embedded in a lot of posters around the actual science. And so the people there were very interested in talking to me about our efforts, and it was basically news to them. So trying to work across those lines to get these kinds of presentations, papers into science sessions where you're actually talking to scientists is very helpful.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we are trying to do in Montreal, but again, finding some challenges. And I would encourage everyone to do that. And as a scientist, I try to put as much education into my science talks and vice versa. And it's amazing how many, the thing that I find amazing is it's amazing how many scientists, if given the chance, want to talk about their outreach stuff. And so one of the things that I would really like to see moving forward is some of these science talks is have not a prerequisite, but a recommendation that for every science talk that, you know, one slide talks or this gives an overview of the outreach that this project has also done.
That's a good idea.
And try to build those connections between those two.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, we're about 5 minutes past the hour, so I just want to thank Jennifer very much for her presentation. It was quite interesting and thought-provoking. So we'll end our call. Next week we have another presentation from Ed Maybach on TV weathercasters as climate educators. So we'll talk to you then. Thank you very much,
everyone.
Yep. Have a good day. Bye.
Bye.